All right, so welcome to the 7411 exam prep session. My name is Brian Swittergall, and I'm going to be guiding you through this afternoon. As some of you know, we have a 7410, a 7411, and a 7412, and they're sort of back to back to back. How many people sat in the 7410 last session? And then how many are going to try to go with the 412 after this one? Wow, quite a number of you guys. And then how many of you are actually going to take the exams this week? Maybe, a couple maybes out there. So one of the things to know is that we've got a ton of information to go through. And for those that sat on the 410, you know, he had covered the OD topics at a high level. And I've gone a little bit different route. We mix it up a little bit. And the PowerPoint deck is just chock full of stuff. So there's going to be points at which I don't cover everything, but it's there for you later. So when you go to download the deck later, if you want to get it from me after the session, it's going to be there for you. We're going to actually touch on every single topic that's covered in OD. So if you go up to that webpage, which we'll talk about in a minute, we're going to cover every single thing. I'm going to say something about every single thing. On the downside, for those that sat in the 410 and the 412, we are going to cover the overview of certification. We got a bunch of new people in here that didn't sit in the 410 or won't sit in the 412. We're going to talk high level about how the certification has changed over time, how we got the MCSA and the MCSE back, things like that. All right, so let's jump right into the overview. After the overview, we're going to dive into the actual exam content and the OD stuff. So on the Microsoft certification front, we have three main levels. We have the associate level. We have the expert level, which is where the MCSE starts. And then we have the master level. Microsoft sort of targets the expert level, the MCSE, as what most people are going to look to attain in their career. And what we're doing today, 7411, is your path to MCSA. And then for those that want to continue, your path to MCSE as well. And then on the MCSE front, you know, back in the old days, you had one MCSE. And everyone that had one kind of had the same knowledge. We've kind of gone a different route now. We have a bunch of different MCSE tracks, and it's based on the exams that you take after your MCSA. And based on those exams, you can end up with MCSE Private Cloud, for instance, or MCSE Server Infrastructure. A couple of others listed down there on the development side as well. Any questions on how the exam process has changed, the designations, MCSE old, MCSE new, MCSA, maybe what you earn from the 7411? All right. So 410, 411, and 412, if you guys go through those and pass them, you have earned your MCSA on Windows Server 2012. And for some people, that's going to be what they're looking to attain. They get that, they're done, they're good. Some people are going to build on that, like I said earlier, go with the MCSE. For those that have previous experience on the certifications, like 2008, 2008 R2, you can actually jump right into the 417. I heard some people talking earlier about taking the 417, and some people will call it a shortcut, but if you've done it before, this is probably your fastest way to get your MCSA, and then obviously to jump up to your MCSE. So all the certifications listed in blue on the left, if you have any of those certifications, little important note here at the bottom for enterprise administrators, then you're qualified to take the 417. On the other hand, for some people, they want to go through the three exams. You study for one exam, study for a second one, and just take them individually. You can also do that. 417 for some people is quite a lot of effort. And so it's kind of up to you and your style and what suits you best. All right, so topics covered on the exam. Three main areas of the Microsoft Learning site. This one here shows the 412. It's the same for all the exams. The real key thing here is the skills measured down here at the bottom. I recommend that everyone go out to the site, look at the skills measured section, because every single thing that's going to be covered on the exam is going to be in the skills measured in one way or another. There is some interpretation, and that's kind of how I'm going to guide you today, my interpretation of the OD as we kind of step through some of the technical stuff. This is something that everyone should do before you take any exam, before you start studying. All right, so let's talk a little bit about knowing what to expect. The exams have changed a lot. you know, and they're going to continue to change a lot. And it's important as a test taker to stay up on all those developments. Couple of things here. All the questions have a consistent anatomy. A lot of you guys have probably seen this stuff. You know, you're the system administrator for Contoso. You manage X. People are reporting this problem. You need to do Y. What should you do? And then you get your four answer choices and move on. That's going to be the format you see pretty much throughout. We'll talk a little bit about the different questions. But that's going to be the stem you see, whether you end up dragging and dropping, or you do a build list, or you do a multiple choice, choose all that apply. This is your foundation. And this lists out kind of what I said here. So let's move on. This is some of the exam question styles that you see out there. There's some new ones up here. How many people have taken an exam in the last, let's call it, 9 months? So maybe about a third of you. So for the rest of you, 100% you're likely going to see styles and types of items that you've never run across before. Microsoft does have some demos of all the items up on the website. I typically like to walk through them just so when you get to them on the exam, you don't waste time trying to figure out what you're supposed to do, or are you doing it right, or reading the, they do have instructions and stuff like that. But instead of bothering with that during the exam, get to this ahead of time and kind of get familiar with them, and then you're more likely to be ready. You can focus on the technical content. So these are the core areas we're going to cover today. These are what they call the functional groups. Deploy, manage, and maintain servers, configure file and print services, configure network services and access, network policy server, Active Directory, and then group policy. For those that sat in on the 410, some of these sort of sound like the same thing that was already talked about. A little bit different, a little bit more advanced, call it a step up. And then when we go to 412 later, for those of you that are going to do that, we're going to step up one more notch. So even though we have some of the same topics, you're not going to see the same questions. They're totally different exams. All right, so this is our first one. The way we're going to kind of operate today, and if you guys go up to the website and check out the exam, deploy, manage, and maintain servers, these are the three categories underneath that on the site. And we're going to dive into them kind of one or two slides per. All right, so let's talk about managed server images. We got two slides on this. You know, when people think about managing server images, we're really talking about WDS. WDS has been around since 2008. It's a role service. And one of the things I'm going to point out over and over again for everything, whether it's WDS or another technology, the things that you got to know how to install it. You got to know how to get it up and running. You want to know the prerequisites. You want to know the PowerShell way of doing it as well. Talked about that a little bit on the 410. I call out a bunch of stuff on here. I'm not going to read you, you know, the commandlets and stuff like that, but these are stuff that you want to be able to pick out, you know, and know. The install-windows feature, key. And you're going to see that for pretty much any feature that you want to install. The test isn't going to really cover you on knowing all the switches or putting two PowerShell commandlets up and it's missing one letter on one and not the other. It's not going to do that kind of stuff. It's more like, do you know the commandlet and do you know the prereqs and stuff like that? So there's three kinds of rule images here. We're going to actually talk about four. We got the boot image, which is basically boot.wim. You guys have probably seen that. This is the kind of information that you're going to need to know for the exam. Knowing what boot.wim is, knowing what an install.wim is, knowing what a discover image is. You know, if you have a computer that can't boot to PXE, you can use a discover image to bring it up and get it on the network and deploy an image to it. Knowing that a capture image is used when you build your reference computer, you want to bring it back in and then you want to deploy it and use it as an install image, for instance. These are what I call core areas, and you definitely want to be familiar with them. And then when we talk about images, the other part is updating them, right? Patches, hotfixes, drivers, and features. The one thing I'm going to call out a lot today, too, is the deprecated stuff. Right. One of the things I always look for when I'm taking an exam is what's deprecated and what's the new way of doing stuff. Because I always want to know the new way, and I want to be wary of the deprecated way. You know, you talked earlier on the 410 about DC promo. You know, it's deprecated. It still kind of works. It doesn't really. You run it, you get the yellow thing. It, you know, Same stuff with some of these things. You want to know what's deprecated and lean toward the new stuff. If you're going to practice and get your hands on like the labs and stuff like that, you want to go through the newer stuff because you're most likely going to be tested on the newer stuff. DISM is the key here. There's actually 22 DISM commandlets. Be familiar with them. You don't need to know all of them. You know, you can know the basics and you know, review them one time, and that's probably enough. And then down here at the bottom, DISM Online enable feature name Telnet client. That's just an example of how to install a feature into an online image. All right, so slide two, update images. We're still talking about, now we're talking about offline images, images that aren't live. That's back to the DISM commandlet again. And now we do the mount image. On the add packager driver, I lay out some sample commandlets. These are definitely things you want to understand and know. I always tell people, you know, it's one thing I can tell you about it, you know, you can read it, but actually go and do it. Like, go type it in and see the error, you know, do a deployment, all that kind of stuff. And then commit the changes and unmount. When you see questions, you know, we talked a little bit in sessions about what should you do first, what should you do next, what should you do last, how do you commit the changes. These little details, key to point out, you know, like the slash commit, because you may have done everything, but you didn't commit it. Now you don't have the full package, right? So sample question at the bottom. You have an existing image that you want to use to deploy the servers. You need to add a package to the image. What should you do first? This is kind of what I talked about, like first, what should you do, what should you do first? We've got to mount the image. So a distractor, a lot of people are looking right for, hey, you want to go past the mount image part, but you really want to mount the image first. So be wary of that stuff. And I've highlighted the answers in advance just to kind of speed through because we've got so much content today. This is the same question from before here. All right, so let's talk about patch management. This is one of the big functional areas. Inside of here is it's big on WSUS, synchronization, and that kind of thing. Talked about installing the role. It's the same thing, install Windows feature. We also have the DISM sample up here. Knowing both of those is key because somebody may have tested just on one. You might not see both. It might even be a choose all that apply, and you know the install Windows feature, but you don't know the DISM. So it's important to even just be familiar with it a little bit. It will be very helpful. And then one of the other key topics, GPO is client-side targeting. There's really two ways to do it. Server-side targeting, this is smaller deployments. You create the groups in WSIS. You can drag the computers in, and then you can deploy based on those groups. And then the client-side targeting, typically done with the GPO. And it's automated membership. So you do a GPO, you call out some groups, and you can automatically, based on where they are in the OU, get them into a server group so that you can patch them. Watch on the test for stuff that says minimize administrative overhead. You know, you may have a question right here about GPOs and WSUS. You want to minimize administrative overhead. The first thing you should be thinking is client-side targeting, right? All right, so let's jump down. Synchronization and WSUS groups. This is where WSUS downloads the updates. When I think about this area on the exam, the first things I'm thinking about are, you know, WAN bandwidth, right, selecting the products, selecting the filters, when are you going to download. If you've got 6 or 8 WSUS servers, are you going to have all of them downloading from the internet, or are you going to chain them? You want to be wary of the bandwidth, the administration overhead, that kind of thing. Another one, the proxy server issue. Troubleshooting questions, right? You have a WSUS server, you deploy it, you try to download the updates, they don't go. What should you do? Where should you look? Proxy server is key. Firewall issue, bits issue, because that's what's used for transfer. These are all the things you want to think about. And then watch for client computers not showing up on the computer list. So when you do the automation in group policy, you're like, hey, I just put this new computer up, what's going on? Well, computer might not have the GPO that tells it what group it's supposed to be in WSIS. So that's all kind of the troubleshooting stuff. All right, so let's jump into monitoring. The key area here is data collector sets. There's 3 types of collectors. You guys have probably seen these. Who here has actually used a data collector set? So maybe about 1/3 of you guys. This is a core area. And one that I totally recommend that you see inside the GUI, actually run through it one time or two times, because if you just try to read this or go through some practice and sample questions, it won't be enough. You really want to go in and configure a couple of collectors, configure some logging, log it to a file, pull the files open, that kind of thing. You do have some built-in templates. I talked a little bit about like minimizing administrative overhead. Always be thinking about what's there already for you. When you think about the templates, that's minimizing administrative overhead. So you got the AD diagnostics, the basic, the system diagnostics. Those are there for you, and that's the key area for the administration time. On the alerting and monitoring, this is specific to real-time performance. The performance counter, when the alert threshold is exceeded, you want to know what you can do when that happens. And that's key. So I list them out here, log an event to the event log. Maybe you have a system center that's looking for certain event IDs that can, you know, go through your regular alerting process. You can run a task. You know, you're running low on disk space. You want to free up the temp. All those kind of things. You just want to know that you can run a task, send an email, and log to the event log. And then you might be able to gather that from somewhere else. But you definitely want to know what actions. You may not need to know how do you do the email or that kind of thing, but you want to know what you're capable of specifically here. And then monitor VMs. This is new. Whenever something's new, I try to call out the prereqs. So in this case, you need a Windows Server 2012 failover cluster. And what you'll see sometimes on an exam is you'll see like monitor the VMs as one of the answers, but you don't have 2012. It looks really appealing. So be aware of the prereqs, because that may save you a couple times. I list out the firewall rule for the VM. Got to be enabled for monitoring. Like I say, we got a ton of content, so I'm going to fly through the key points, and this will be also here for you later to go back over. When you do monitor the VMs, you can monitor the services. You can monitor, you can restart a service upon failure. You can move the VMs, reboot the VMs. You can do just about anything. And you want to be aware of that, again, the capabilities. So monitor events. When we're thinking about events, we're thinking about the event logs, you know. Key here is centralizing events. Event log data to a single collector. You want to know how to set that up. What are the requirements? WinRM, quick config. You want to know about the firewall. You want to know about the minimum operating system versions for this. And then you want to know stuff like works in the non-domain environment, but you got to set the trusted host. For those that were in the 410, we talked a little bit about the trusted host scenario. Because in a non-domain environment, you're not going to be trusted by default where you are in the domain environment. And that'll definitely be a perfect exam item for somebody. On the event subscriptions, I recommend everyone go create one. Even if you know it and you see the commands and that kind of thing, just create one. It'll take literally 2 or 3 minutes. If you do that with every section of the OD, you're going to be in a lot better shape to pass the exam. So use the event viewer to create the subscription. Know that it goes to the forwarded events log. You know, you might be saying, hey, I configured the thing. I don't see any of the events. I'm looking at the system event log. Where is it? It's in the forwarded event stuff. That's another, you know, sample question. And then network monitoring. Not highly likely to come up, the operations manager stuff with the management packs and things like that, but just be aware that you have that available. The performance monitor, you can do alerting or logging like I talked about earlier. All right, so that brings us up to our example question. So you have a standalone Hyper-V host running 2012. You need to monitor VMs. What should you do first? Again, that same first question. Always be looking for that. And in this case, you know, we've got a standalone server. We talked earlier, prereq is the failover cluster. So the first thing we do is go with the failover cluster. All right, so on to the next section. This is file and print services. Some of the new stuff that we don't see on 410 here is like the DFS, the FSRM, file and disk. It's all pretty new, even though it's the same kind of general topic that you see on the 410. It's a little bit on the higher level side. So let's talk DFS. DFS, again, you want to know how to install and configure it. You want to know that there's two different namespaces. You got your domain namespace, and then you have your standalone namespace. Some of the stuff like the 50,000 folders, not probably going to come out. They're not going to try to trick anybody on trivia or, you know, stuff that's not going to come up real world, but you want to know some of those limits sometimes. The key thing here talk about like access-based enumeration where you only see what you've got access to, you've got to have DFS in the Windows Server 2008 mode. I think if I was going to say one thing on the whole slide, it's know what that mode is, know how to get to it, maybe even know that it's actually default if you're doing it in 2012 and you don't have DFS already. And because you may see some questions on that. And knowing the force functional level and stuff like that is going to be very important. That's something that like I would read through right before I walk into an exam is just that kind of stuff. Second page for DFS. So DFS replication targets, keeping stuff in sync. You can use the replicate folder wizard. One thing is, though, the config changes got to replicate. And then each of the namespace servers have to be brought up to speed. So in a troubleshooting scenario, one of the things I kind of call out is, you know, you got to pull the DC, you got to get the config changes. Well, you need to speed it up. You need to do it right now. What do? There's our question. And you have the DFSR diag command. Even knowing DFSR diag, huge. Because you're not going to get DFSR diag like four in a row with all the different switches. You're going to get DFSR diag and then a bunch of stuff that doesn't make sense. And just knowing that is huge for the exam. Let's talk a little bit about replication scheduling. So I list out the steps here and some of the options. We won't read through them all right now. One thing I want to point out is watching for the staging folder size issues. This is one of the things, if you go out to TechNet and you start reading about DFS, that's one of the key things that comes up is if your staging folder is too small, high CPU, slow replication, same thing, troubleshooting scenario, you're going to get these symptoms and you're going to be scratching your head. And if you just remember this, you're in good shape. Let's jump into FSRM. Again, add Windows feature name, include the management tools. The include management tools, I haven't really talked about that. You may see that called out. You know, you need to install a feature and you want to make sure you have the management tools. You'll get one without the include, one with the include. You want to include. For the most part, always look for the one that includes because in the real world, when you install stuff, you include them. So I always go with that. And then on the quota side, quota's been around for a long time. You can do it on a specific folder or on a path. Key differentiator here is on the path means when you create new folders, you already have your quotas in place. So it's not hard-coded. There's built-in templates. We talked earlier, it minimizes administrative overhead. That's where the templates come in. And then the deprecated tools, dir quota. So instead of using dir quota, you want to look at like set FSRM quota, the PowerShell version, right? I'm going to call a few more of these out and you know just want to run through them before you walk the exam. So file screens, how many of you guys have actually used file screens in production? Only a few of you. So the good news is with file screens, it's easy to learn. This is one of those things where I'd say if you read it and read it again, you may not even need to do it to get through it, but you know, don't risk it too much. There's basically active screening and passive screening. Passive screening is, you know, management comes to you and they want to find out how many MP3s are on the network or something like that. And then you're going to go with passive. And then usually you find out what you have and then you start locking it down and then you end up, you know, going the other direction. We talked about built-in templates. I think I'm going to talk about that like pretty much on every topic. Wherever there's built-in templates, built-in anything, that's the minimize administrative overhead. Definitely jump into that. And then deprecated file screen.exe. Instead, I list out some of the new stuff. Set FSRM file screen, exception, and then the template. These are probably the only three you need to know. There's some others out there. On the reporting side, you know, be aware of the different formats. You don't need to know much more than that you have different formats available to you guys. You have some built-in reports, and that again goes to the minimize administrative overhead, duplicate files, file screen audit. People, you know, think of a scenario where you have a file server and it's running low on space. Well, what can you do to figure out how to save space? Well, I can run the duplicate files report. And that's, you know, obviously a good one to use. And then you can also do the schedule reports and have reports emailed. That's kind of handy. You can see kind of trends and stuff like that. So file and disk encryption, we actually have three slides on this. And so new features. When you take these exams, I always tell everyone, got to know the new features. Even if you haven't put them in, you're not using them in production, at least know about them and know what they're capable of and maybe know the commandlets associated with them. We've got BitLocker provisioning. Encrypt only the used disk space. So that's that huge time saver right there. Anybody who's ever done encryption on a full disk, it takes hours or longer, even more. And so you can do it on unused or only on the used space. And then standard users can change their BitLocker PIN and password now. They don't need to have admin rights. So everyone that's got the lockdown users, this is huge. And then the encrypted hard drive. So what we're talking about here is you go down to the store and it's got built-in encryption support. And BitLocker can use that hardware level is support to basically enhance performance and offload. All right, so let's talk about the BitLocker encryption. This stuff has been around for a little while. TPM version 1.2 or higher. That's been around probably for those that took 2008 R2 exams. Owner authorization is the new thing for Windows 8. It does require a schema update. That's like one of those key things that it's just one sentence, but just knowing that is key. And then add the BitLocker drive encryption feature, enable-BitLocker. Need the volume encryption key method, couple of different options. Knowing those things and moving forward, you're going to be good. All right, so let's talk about another new feature, the network unlock feature. So it actually has a WDS prerequisite, and that will stand out like a sore thumb, because that's not something that most of you are going to think, you know, hey, I got BitLocker, I want to do this network unlock, oh, I'm going to deploy WDS. It just doesn't feel like it flows, but that's a prereq. I list out the rest of them here. You want to know those and scan them before you walk in for an exam. So network unlock, you know, I mentioned this, the two-factor authentication. You guys know security is getting to be huge. It wouldn't be out of line for a security question. You want to maximize security. You want to do multiple factors. Network unlock actually allows multiple factors because it works only if it's on your network, the ones that you designate, and if it's not, then you got to have the passcode. And then finally, configure BitLocker policies, Win8 or 2012 only, we're talking. All of the options here with the asterisk, we're talking about, you have three options, fixed, operating, or removable. So you can set the policies based on the type of disk that you have, and that might come up in a scenario. You know, you want to make sure that removable drives have one set of security and the fixed drives have another. Knowing that you can do the different policies is important. And then last one on file and disk encryption. EFS, that's been around since Windows 2000. Hopefully you guys have seen or used that. Not much has really changed there. We still have the data recovery agent. You still obtain the certificate. And I list out that you can do it in ADDS, or you can actually do serve files if it's not published. I wouldn't go too much farther on that part. And then manage EFS and BitLocker certificates. This is going to be stuff like enable archiving on the template. Think about the troubleshooting scenario where you enable archiving, but all your certificates were already deployed. And now something happens, you need to do recovery. Well, it's not there, right? So you need to get the recovery configured, then deploy the template, and then you're in a better position. You can do a self-signed cert, then you back it up with a standard backup method. And then a couple of really small tidbits. I wouldn't get too worried about these, but the Windows 7 requires permissions update to the MSTPM owner information attribute. Just that I set it for some people, that's enough. You may see it pop out somewhere on an exam. It's key. But it's a tidbit. I wouldn't spend more than 3 minutes on it. And then the last thing, again, we talk about the prereqs. Backup BitLocker recovery to ADDS. This has been around since 2008 R2 for those of you that worked with it. Pre-2008 requires a schema extension. All right, so that brings us to our example question. So the reason I put this question up there is watch for requirements. I got three requirements up here. Watch for requirements that really, they're not part of the answer. You know, I say users must be able to create 3,000 total folders. If you don't know the limits and know the technology, that may go, oh man, I better do domain-based or standalone can do 50,000, I better do that one. That's just a made-up requirement. It doesn't actually tie into the question. Minimize changes to the environment. Always look for the key ones. The key one here is users must not be able to see the folders they do not have access to. That should, you know, ding, ding, ding. That's Abe. And because we talked about it earlier, Abe requires, and you go down to the domain base with the 2008 mode. So this question was kind of two pieces, right? Learn the technology so you can answer them, but then also watch for these nuances in the bulleted requirements, because you don't necessarily have to answer all the bullets. You just need to meet the goal. All right, so let's jump into advanced. You know what? Let me pause. Sorry, guys. I'm flying through. Any questions on what we covered so far? I know we're going at a really breakneck pace, and there's so many slides. So I want to be able to get it all to you, and then as we have time at the end, we can always loop back and go through some question and answer. But if you do have something, jump out, raise your hand, and we can pause kind of midway through. Copy the slides, I found out this morning, not available till next week, but if you come up to see me afterwards, I'll copy them onto your USB. All right, so advanced audit policies. So you guys have probably been doing auditing since NT4, you know, 2000, 2003. Auditing is, you know, you go in and log on, log off, file, registry access, that kind of thing. We're talking really about the advanced audit policies, and knowing the difference between those is my key point here, because there's going to be, there may be a requirement for certain level of auditing that the basic auditing isn't going to handle. And if you haven't looked at the advanced stuff, it's much more granular in 2012. And you can pop open the group policy management console and have a look at like the default stuff there, and that right there is going to be huge. I call out the command line version, the audit pull command. That's still valid. It wouldn't shock me if somebody came across that. And then you have the backup and restore switch on that as well. Global object access auditing. So this is, you know, for those people that do a lot of like auditing, you got to go and configure the auditing on the GPO, and then you got to go to the folder, and you got to go to select the resource. This is supposed to make all that easier. So we talk about like minimize administrative overhead. Be thinking global object access, right? Be thinking the advanced audit policy as soon as you see that type of stuff. Second slide on this, expression-based audit policy. So this is like, hey, I want to audit anybody in payroll that tries to access something that, you know, they don't have access to. And this is just a made-up example. But expression-based is you pick who or what or what attribute or what the scenario is or where the file is and what are they trying to do. And based on that expression, you'll get a log in your, you get a log entry in your log. And then you can act on that. And then new for Windows 8 and 2012 is removable device audit policy. So if somebody plugs in a USB, you want to know about it, gets logged. If they attempt to, what was the other thing I wanted to say here? Yeah, access to removable storage device. Those are kind of the same thing. There's the parentheses stuff is actually the GPO setting itself right there. All right, so let's jump into network services and access. We're going to talk about zones, DNS, DNS records. And then we'll kind of switch gears into VPN routing and direct access. For those that sat in the 410, we didn't really dive into these particular things. It was a different level, so this will be all new for this particular exam. So zone files, standard stuff, primary, secondary. You can store the primary in ADDS, secondary, no ADDS. That would be a good distractor. Know the difference between a stub zone and a conditional forwarder. Think about an exam scenario like a merger acquisition. You're Contoso, you bought Fabricom. You need to resolve their names. They need to resolve yours. Should you use a stub zone or a conditional forwarder? It depends, maybe, right? It depends on the requirements. I list a few out here. Stub zone's best when the DNS servers are going to actually change often. If they're going to be static, you're going to actually do a merger. You're probably good on the conditional stuff. But if it's a big network and things are changing, and then you might be better on stub zones. Conditional forwarders, forward to specific DNS servers. One of the benefits there is you build up a cache. So if you forward to specific DNS servers, even if you have a whole bunch, those servers build up a huge cache, and then that can be a little bit more efficient. So you might watch for scenarios where, hey, we need the most efficient name resolution possible. That's what you want to be thinking about. And then I call out the merger acquisition and speeding up internal name resolution. So if you have the two companies, instead of going out to the internet, to the root servers and coming back through, you can just go straight across if the networks are connected. So DNS zones, zoning conditional forward storage and Active Directory. The DNS server service has to run on the domain controller to store the zone in Active Directory. You guys probably know that. Replication. These are the different options. Just being aware that you can go to all DNS plus DCs in a forest, all DCs in a domain, or in a partition. This is going to be another scenario where it's like, hey, I want to replicate my DNS, but I want to minimize the replication. Well, then you want to go with the option that minimizes the replication. Zone delegation. This is specifically called out as a minor topic, but you want to know why. Why do you zone delegate? Management. We talk about merger acquisition. Those guys are going to take care of their zone now. Distribute the load. You only have a couple of DNS servers at your primary location. You want to distribute the load to some other servers. On the zone transfer settings, this best security is the specific list. So, you can do zone transfers to any server. You can do it to just a specific server, just the servers on the name servers tab. There's multiple ways, but knowing like which one minimizes replication, minimizes WAN bandwidth, maximizes security, those are going to be key. I call out security because that's kind of a big focus. The notify settings, this is the secondary servers. Instead of waiting for them to pull and grab all the DNS stuff, you notify them. Hey, we made some changes. Here they are. I got them. Come pull them. Being aware of just what that means is important. Questions on DNS before we move on? Totally switch into a new topic. Well, no. DNS records now. Sorry. So everyone knows the typical records. We talked about this in the 410 for those that were here, but you got to know the difference between A, the quad A, PTR, NS. You got to know what these are, where you might find them. The key thing I call out is the IPv6A record, right? Knowing what that is. The DNS command with the record add for mass creation, also can use PowerShell. I call them both out, just knowing them, add DNS server resource record. And then you talk about the zone name and the type of record it is. Knowing the commandlet, knowing the DNS command, that's going to be critical. And then on the zone scavenging, this one tricks a lot of people up. People will enable zone scavenging and, you know, it's like nothing's being scavenged and it's like, hey, what's going on? And it's not done at all the right different levels. So I call them out here. Must enable at the server and the zone level. Troubleshooting scenario, though, for the exam might be must also be enabled at the resource record level on by default. But you might run across a situation where it's on at the server and zone level and you're not seeing the scavenging. It's like, well, check the resource record level. And then cleans up only the dynamic records, not the static ones. And then finally, avoid DNS command with the age all records, because age all records is indeed all the records, static included. So more about records. Configure the record options with the TTL and the wait. So knowing the TTL default is an hour, and then the wait. We talk about wanting to favor a certain server for a service. Maybe you have three or four web servers and you don't want to load balance them. You really want server one to handle like 60% of the traffic. You can use wait in your DNS records to favor a certain server. Round robin, this can be disabled for some of the record types. The local subnet priority takes precedence. So if you've got two different IPs for a host name and one matches your local IP, that's the one that takes precedence. These scenarios could definitely come up on the exam. And then the secure dynamic updates. They have to be ADDS integrated. I think that one, you know, has been around for a long time. You guys probably know that. I put out the DNS command here for allow update 2 to force the zone to secure only. Probably not going to see something that granular, but it's up here. Good to know it. Can't hurt. OK, now we jump into VPN and routing. So the remote access role, that's the standard add Windows feature. The one thing to know after that, you got to run the enable routing and remote access wizard. So after the feature's in, nothing happens. Right? You got to run through the wizard, tell it what you want to do. Do you want to do VPN? Do you want to do direct access, whatever? And then implementing NAT would be part of that wizard as well. You need two interfaces. So sample question, right? You got a server. You want to do network address translation. It's got a single NIC. What should you do first? Add a second NIC, something like that. Configure the VPN settings. I think the big thing here, the newer stuff, you're not going to probably see a bunch of PPTP stuff, you know, from way back when. You're probably going to see SSTP. And the important thing there is selecting the right SSL certificate after the install. Otherwise, it's not going to be functional. Remote dial-in settings for users. So default in AD is through the MPS network policy, and you need to adjust that policy or make a new policy, or you're not going to get anybody to come in. So troubleshooting scenario again, you set it up, you got all the users in, and no one's able to get in. What do you do? And you got to go adjust the policy. And then finally, bottom here, configure routing. IPv4 and 6, static routes, DHCP relay, these are the types of things we're talking about when we configure routing. Need to enable the router for the protocol. So we're talking about DHCP relay in that case. And direct access. This one's a tough one on the exam. Because if I were to list off, you know, let's say we talked to 10 or 12 topics so far, and I'd say, you know, 75% of you have probably worked with most of those. When we start getting into direct access and some of the other stuff, the numbers start dwindling. So if I was to make a recommendation, I'd say spend some time on direct access. Don't read it once or twice. Spend a little bit of time on it. So first thing is the server requirements. And I don't know if we dive into the network requirements or not. So it doesn't require PKI anymore. That's key. That used to be kind of a common scenario to study for. You got a new simplified deployment. When you do that, though, that's when you get into you're missing out on some of the features. Forced tunneling, so you can force everyone to all network traffic through one network. You don't get the NAP integration, and you don't get the two-factor. So be aware that you have some caveats if you use this simplified deployment. You might see a scenario where, you know, hey, you need to have direct access, and you need to have one of those three features, but you want to minimize the administration to do it. Well, it's not going to be the simplified deployment, even though, because it doesn't meet the requirements, right? Single NIC card behind NAT, got to have Windows Server 2012. This is another little tidbit that I recommend to remember. And then remote access servers and all client computers must be domain members. You might see a scenario about that. The transition technologies for IPv6, I don't dive into them at all here. It would be helpful to know them. You know, if the word Torito or 6-4, if that sounds like I'm talking a foreign language, then definitely sit down for a few minutes and just, even if it's a paragraph, and just read through it and understand what it does and what it means. And then finally, on the client side, you need to have security groups in place. You know, who's going to be able to get into direct access? You want a security group for those. And you got to create the GPLs. Otherwise, you don't have your functionality. You're not fully set up and configured and ready to go. Slide 2, direct access. So configure DNS. How many people have heard of the name resolution policy table? All right, so maybe like 5%. Use to send specific queries to specific DNS servers. So, and this is specific to direct access for the most part. You know, if you're doing remediation and you want them to find a certain thing, but you don't want that to be accessible to the regular clients, read about it. I only have a little bit here. Windows 7 or later required, config via the GPL, but definitely dive into that a little bit. That's another new one, and the new stuff tends to get, you know, on the exams. And then configure the certificates. If you are using an internal CA or self-sign, your CRL distribution point has to be available from the internet. Can't use self-sign cert if you have a multi-site environment. These are all the little caveats that you want to be aware of. I'm not saying memorize them all, but just knowing about them can be helpful. And then if you can't do the Kerberos proxy over HTTPS, you've got to do internal PKI. Anything on direct access? All right, brings us to our example question. You are the sysadmin at Tailspin Toys. Another administrator added a new DNS record for www2, points to an IP, forward name resolution's working, but the admins are reporting that they can't resolve the actual IP address. What should you do? And this kind of ties back to our DNS stuff a few minutes ago. And it is a D, add a PTR record. These are the kinds of questions that I'd expect when you talk about like the DNS resource records, all that kind of stuff. I just wrote these up, but this is kind of what to expect. Maybe a little bit harder. Okay, that takes us to network policy server infrastructure. We're going to talk about MPS, the policies, and then we're going to talk a little bit about NAP. So first thing is radius. So there's five parts: access clients, access servers. I list them all up here. Knowing what they are and what they do, sometimes people get confused when you talk about like a client and a server, you know. So be aware of the differences there. Be aware of the MPS proxy. So we talk about maximizing security, and you start thinking about proxy servers in the DMZ. That's what you want to be thinking about. And then finally, NetSH. We talked about it in 4.10. I heard him talking about it. It's the same in 4.11. It's even the same in 4.12. This command continues to crop up. Be aware what it's capable of, because it does come into play here. And then on the Radius client, so the requirements are you need a shared secret, you need a friendly name, you need an IP or a domain name, and then the vendor info. Some of you guys probably set this up where you put in, you know, the vendor like a Cisco when you're setting it up. Radius templates. So we talk about administrative overhead. There are existing Radius templates, and you want to tackle those and use them if you can. Sometimes you can build on the templates or copy them and then deploy something new. All right, so Radius accounting. This is, you know, who's doing what, logging, think security. Can log to a SQL database, text file, or both. That's kind of a key point here, right? Is you got your SQL database, it fills up with space, doesn't log anymore, you're out of compliance. Well, you can actually fail it over to a text file. And otherwise, you can actually say, hey, no one gets in anymore, right? And that's for some organizations, compliance, security, that's going to be big. Configuring the certificates. If you do certificate-based auth, your MPS server needs a certificate. Pretty straightforward there. And then auto-enrollment, we talk about this over and over again, right? Think about the ways that you can make this less time-consuming, less administrative overhead, and that's going to be auto-enrollment through GPL. All right, so we talk about the MPS policies. This really dictates who gets in, and you have your type, your day, your time, which computer, which groups, that kind of thing. If you have an MPS server and there's no local processing, then it's a proxy. And it can forward to one or more different places. Okay, so one of the things at the bottom here, watch for the default installation on encryption, because you've got 40-bit, 56-bit, and 128-bit. And for the most part, no one should be using anything but 128-bit. Might come out as a security thing. Hey, you got a default installation of this. You want to maximize security. Which settings should you change? Well, that's probably one of them. And then IP filters to enhance security. You can limit your traffic type if you want to say only IPv6, only IPv4. Be aware that those are there. And you can combine the IP filters with the other policies and really narrow and tighten the environment a little bit. So MPS templates, you can use a template for just about everything. The shared secrets, the Radius clients, the Radius servers, all the policies, they're all there. Definitely want to look at those. Even if you don't deploy them or use them, just pop through them and look what they have in there. Maybe create one. And then importing and exporting. We talked about NetSH. Also, export MPS configuration. That's kind of like a backup type of thing too, right? Anything on MPS or any of the preceding sections? All right, so let's jump into NAP, Network Access Protection. We've got a few things to talk about here. System health validators, there's one built-in one. That's the Windows Security Health Validator. This is the same stuff you guys have probably seen a few times. Do you have any viruses? Are the virus definitions up to date? Is the firewall on? Those kind of things. The one caveat is the spyware protection. No XP for that. So you got a mixed environment, some legacy clients. You want to maximize security. Don't pick spyware protection, for all clients at least. And then if you're non-compliant with the validator, then you can restrict access or remediate. So you can say no access and call the help desk, and then you can fix them up. Or they can go to remediation server, get the latest updates, push out some installation software if they're missing some software. So the policies, the health policies in the middle here, dictate how many of the tests have to pass. Like, hey, if the guy's up to date on antivirus, but his spyware's out of date, I'm going to let him in. That's what you do with the policy. Determine how many you want to pass, how many you want to fail. Obviously, if you fail one and you're gone, that's the highest security. And you combine the policies with the network policies, you know, where you're coming from and that kind of thing, to determine who actually eventually gains access. All right, so NAP enforcement, non-compliant devices, the three options, full access with limited time, And the whole goal with that is it makes it hard for people to work. You know, you go 20, 15, 20 minutes, and they have to reconnect, and they have to reconnect. That makes it hard for people to work. They call the help desk, you remediate it. That's a medium security environment. And then limited access. That's usually your most secure setting. That's the ones I like to focus on for the exam. You're going to get access to your remediation network or maybe the corporate intranet that has some help files on how to do what you need to do to get compliant. Final line here. You know, if you have full network and limited time, and then in that limited time you become compliant, you're going to become disconnected anyway. So that can be a troubleshooting scenario. You know, hey, you got the guy compliant, he got disconnected. What's going on? Well, that's what's going on. Okay, so more NAP. Configure isolation and remediation of the non-compliant computers. One thing to know is the automatic remediation is enabled, but you don't have any remediation servers. Nothing's actually going to happen. Add remediation servers and a troubleshooting URL. That's kind of like the intranet spot or wherever that might have some help files for them. We talked about NetSH for some of the configuration. One thing to know is a group policy overrides whatever you do via NetSH. So another troubleshooting kind of scenario. I highlight by default NAP enforcement clients are disabled. That's something key to remember. And then to enforce the health policies, you got to have one NAP enforcement client. So when you think about the order, you're thinking about the NAP enforcement client, then the health policy. All right, so we're actually going to jump to a whole new section, configure and manage Active Directory. Service authentication, we're talking about service accounts there, domain controllers, maintaining some of the stuff, and then account policies, lockout, password, fine-grained stuff. So on service authentication, create and configure service accounts. The key thing here are the group managed service accounts. You guys have probably seen managed service accounts. How many people are actually using managed service accounts? Got a couple out there. So managed service accounts weren't, they were a benefit and they were good and all, but they weren't really there and ready because they're too much work still. Group managed service accounts kind of takes care of that. The main differentiator is use them on multiple computers. You might see some questions where you've got a managed service account, a group managed service account. If you don't know what group managed means, you may not be selecting that kind of thing as your answer because group manage it, you know, it may not make sense. So be aware of those differences. For the group managed stuff, you've got to do it on a computer running Windows 8 or 2012. And you've got to have at least one DC that runs 2012. So we talked earlier about the importance of the prereqs. You've got to know those prereqs. If you know the prereqs and you know what group managed service accounts are, you're going to be in good shape for the exam. And then I list out the PowerShell commandlet. New AD service account, set AD service account, real straightforward. The great news with all the PowerShell stuff, guys, if you don't know it, it reads like, you know, literally. So, you know, new this, new that, set this, set that, get this, get that. And be looking for that. You may not know all the PowerShell stuff for all the features, but just be aware of those typical verbs, and you're going to be in pretty good shape. The managed service accounts, those are the ones from 2008 R2. You can still do them with the same commandlet. You restrict to a single computer to make it a managed service account compared to a group managed. Can be used on a single server and no good for scheduled task exchange or SQL. So watch for those because those are the types of caveats that can crop up on an exam. Question in the back. Or SharePoint. Thank you. Thank you. So SharePoint has its own managed accounts from the back. A couple more things on service authentication. The Kerberos delegation, so the setting trust this computer for delegation to any service. For IIS scenarios, may require that setting. And then managing SPNs. Set SPN, the one thing to remember is it no longer can do duplicates in 2012. It's probably the key thing. So you might see a scenario where there's a duplicate set SPN. Well, there's no 2012, and maybe it derives some info when you can get to the answer. All right, so configure domain controllers. The first topic up is universal group membership caching. This has been around for a long time. I don't want to spend too much time on it. Eliminates the dependency on GC during logons. You definitely want to know that. It's going to be there are certainly going to be some scenarios where if there's a branch office, a main office, you want to minimize logon time. You want to be able to log on without a GC, WAN link, all those kind of scenarios. You want to be familiar with universal group membership caching and some of the other things. Like we'll talk about branch cache. I think it's in 4.12 though. Transfer and seize the operations masters. This is the same method for the most part that you guys had since 2000. NTDS util. You can actually transfer roles. Some people get tripped up on that. Most people think NTDS for seizing, but you can actually transfer. Because a lot of people go to the GUI to do the transfer. If everything's cool, go to the GUI. But you can do it via NTDS util. You may see that on an exam, and it's only transfer. So watch for something like that. And then let's talk RODC. Can upgrade a writable DC to a RODC. That probably is pretty straightforward for most people. And then the staged installation. This is pretty key. You're going to ship out a domain controller to a remote site. There's no admin. The accounting lady's going to shove it into a closet. She's not a domain admin. You don't want to make her a domain admin. You can do a staged installation. She can actually complete the process, and you don't have to hand out excessive rights to do it. So that's kind of cool. I called out IFM for speed. If you were in the 410, that was, you know, you ship it out there with the backup of the other DC. You know, no replication really needed, just a little bit, and you got a double whammy. All right, so let's talk about cloning. This is a new one. I definitely would urge everyone to know at least high level what you can do and how to do it. You need Hyper-V on 2012, or you need VMware 5.0 or later. The source VM's got to be 2012. Your PDC emulator's got to be 2012. So in general, you got to have a pretty new environment. And then I list out the steps. Add the source DC to the group, run the commandlet, export the DC, and then you import the DC, and you got your clone. So two files to call out, the default DC clone allow list. So that is a default file. That's why it's called default. And it has all the services that are supported for cloning. So sometimes you go to clone something, and it'll check through that file. And if the service isn't listed, not supported. And then you get a little error. So a lot of people run other stuff on their DCs. And if that other stuff's probably not going to be called out in the default, right? So then you can go with a custom DC clone allow list. And that is ones where the vendor said, hey, this is good. We support cloning. But you got to add our stuff into the custom XML file. When you do that, now you're ready to clone. There's actually a really good blog post on this. I've called it out at the bottom. I'd recommend everyone go through it. It really dives deep into the cloning process and all the gotchas, step-by-step screenshots, all that kind of stuff. So maintaining Active Directory, backups, maintenance, the typical day-to-day type of stuff. Some of the stuff is like once in a lifetime, but wbadmin start system state backup. Everyone should know how to initiate an on-demand backup of Active Directory. That's kind of what I'm calling out here. If you do the system state backup, you also get the sysvol. So you might see a question about, hey, you need to back up the system state. You also need to include the sysvol. What should you do? And it might say, back up the whole C drive. No, back up the system state. But it'll try to throw you like that, so just be aware of this. Manage Active Directory offline, for the most part, a little bit newer. You can stop the ADDS service. You can perform some maintenance, like a defrag. You want to move the files around. And then you can start the service up. There's still, that domain controller becomes effectively not usable while the service is not running. But you don't have to reboot it. And if you have other stuff running on it, like print or something like that, then it's still actually a valid and functional service. And then optimize an Active Directory database. This is a little bit of a trivia thing. LDIF can be used to manually kick off a garbage collection. So instead of waiting 12 hours, you can actually do it right now. Frees up some white space in the database. And doesn't free up any disk space, though. So a difference between freeing up white space in the database and disk space. So be watching for that. And then you can actually compact the DIT file itself. The real big thing to remember here, you actually need to be able to hold a second copy of the DIT. And if your C drive has 500 megs free and your database is a gig, there's no compacting. Got to have another drive. All right, Active Directory, cleaning up the metadata. How many of you guys have actually cleaned up the metadata, bad DC, didn't come back up, blue screen, hardware problem, whatever? So a good chunk of you. It's really the same process. It's NTDS util. The big change here, though, for minimizing administrative overhead, making things simpler, is since 2008, if you just go delete the DC from Sites and Services or ADUC, how many people have actually tried that and seen the little pop-up that says that they're going to clean it up? It's a really cool feature, and I still have admins that are going in to do NTDS util because they've never done that, and they thought, oh, no, no, don't do that. So be aware, because it does minimize administrative overhead. Active Directory snapshots, NTDS util, activate the instance, and then create. Those are the actual commands from NTDS util. Performing object and container level recovery. So NTDS util or restore AD object. So the one thing here, big scenario, you got a guy in a bunch of groups and you restore him. You don't have the recycle bin. You don't have his groups. So we talk about the link value attributes, need the recycle bin. You do the restore AD object. You can actually restore the object in its entirety. You may get a scenario where it's like, hey, we need to restore this and you need to meet these requirements. And one of the requirements may be something that requires a recycle bin. What should you do first? Put the recycle bin in. And then how to enable the recycle bin? Won't walk through it, but be aware of how to do that. Finally, the AD restore stuff. This is stuff that's been rehashed over and over since 2000. You know, authoritative, non-authoritative. Be aware of the difference. I won't talk too much about this. This is pretty commonplace. But you want to know in a certain scenario which one you use. You know, if you get a scenario, I think I call one out, where you restore the guy, and then an hour later he gets deleted, and you restore him and he gets deleted, then you know what's going on, hopefully. All right, so let's talk about account policies. So configure the domain user password policy. We're talking about without fine grain, the standard stuff, domain or the default domain policy, one policy per domain, one lockout policy, configure via the GPO. Fine grain is really what you're going to want to study up on. You want to know how to put it in place and how to actually assign it. The key here is not an OU. You might get a question like, hey, you want to really minimize the administrative overhead, put it on the OU, put it on the user, and you'd be thinking, oh, well, the OU would be perfect. All my users are in one OU. No good. So you want to be aware of that, and then you also want to know about the ADAC, Active Directory Administrative Center, because that's where you can actually go in, and if you were interested in using a GUI for this whole thing, that's where you would do it. And that might be your only choice on the exam. So you want to know the PowerShell way, you want to know the ADAC way, just be aware of it. And then delegating password settings management. So maybe you want your help desk to be able to do a password, fine-grained password policy for a subset of users. You can actually delegate that, and it's the right property permission on the PSO itself. You probably don't need to really remember that, but I just wanted to point it out. Local user password policy. You know, this is a little thing a lot of people don't know. You can actually do a GPO link to an OU with all the computers and do the local password policy for local accounts on the server. Not likely to come up, but something to know. And then the lockout settings. Knowing what all the zeros mean is probably the biggest thing. That's why I call those out. The lockout duration, administrator has to unlock. Lockout threshold, you never get locked out. Reset the lockout. You think about it, it's all going to be security-based, minimize administrative overhead, massive influx of calls to the help desk. Those are going to be the types of things that these settings are going to start coming at you. So be aware of what they do, because I expect people to run into them. Any questions on passwords, password policies, fine grain? All right, so let's talk about group policy. Processing order and precedence. If there's only one thing you remember from the slide, LSDOU. Who here knows what LSDOU is? Go.
Local site domain OU.
Yeah, that's it. Local site domain OU. That's the order that they process them in. So what happens if you have a local policy and then a policy on the OU? OU comes later, it takes precedence. That's something to know. And then if you've got two GPOs linked to the same place, you have your link order. One is the highest, top of the list. So if you're ever looking at the management console, and the one that's on the top, that's the highest priority, the one they call the one. Nothing above will apply for the configure blocking. So if you block inheritance, go ahead.
So the link order is one, the one that applies last?
No, that's the one that takes precedence. So yeah, I guess that's two different ways of saying the same thing. Blocking inheritance, nothing above will apply unless the GPO is enforced. You've got to know that. This is something you definitely have to know. The opposite of that is, hey, somebody blocked inheritance, you need to get your GPO down there. How do you do it? You enforce it. That overrides the block. And then, you know, how to configure and right-click enforce. This particular slide you definitely want to go through a few times. You guys probably already know this, probably not a lot of time needs to be spent here. Security filtering, WMI filtering, you know, you can apply by default as authenticated users, everyone gets it. That includes computers. But if you want to narrow it down a little bit, apply something to the domain and you create a security group and only has a certain number of users, kind of simplifies things. Know about the WMI filtering. I call out one that's kind of common, you know, how to apply a GPO only to Windows 2012 data center, for instance. That's a WMI filter you can use. You can do it for XP. That's probably the most common thing today. Loopback processing. Just know the two things. You got replace or merge. So if you replace, then it replaces everything. If you merge, they all come together as one. Bottom thing is watch for the kiosk or public computers. All users got to have the exact same settings. That's where you're going to get into loopback processing. And then third slide on this is configure slow link processing. Default is 500 kbps. And it's configured in that particular area of the group policy. Not much to really say there. There's a couple things like software installation and folder redirection that if you're on a slow link, they don't apply. So you may see something like that on an exam. And then the client-side extension behavior. This allows you to override some of those default settings, like allow processing across a slow network connection. Of course, I wouldn't recommend doing software distribution to like Office over slow connection and using that setting to do it. Not effective. And then the other one, process, even if group policy objects have not changed. If you ever get into a scenario where you have a preference and you set it one time and then the user changes it later, that's kind of where this comes into play. May or may not get a scenario on that. Group policy settings. Specifically, we're going to talk about software installation. There's a few folder redirection scripts. You want to be familiar with all of them, but the software installation, assign and publish. These are the keys that have been on exams for a long time. You can assign to a user or assign to a computer, and you can publish to a user. Can't publish to a computer. And be aware of what happens if you publish to a user. You know, does it show up in their start menu? Does it actually install it? You know, if you assign it to a user, when does it install? On startup or when they first log on? You want to be familiar with all that kind of stuff. This stuff is specifically called out on the OD, and I definitely expect it on there. And then the security templates. The one thing that I call out here is it clear this database before importing. So when you do import, that will actually overwrite. And then if you don't actually do that to clear it, you get a merge. And then you may not know what you're going to get, because the policy you're importing has everything you want. Well, then you want to clear it and then bring it in. You don't want to merge. You don't know what's there. So importing a custom administrative template. People, you guys have probably done this Office and a lot of third-party applications. They provide an ADM, ADMX, and you can import this, and then you can control Word and all that kind of stuff, right? Be aware of where you do that, how you do it. Be aware about the central store. Specifically that ADM not supported in the central store, that ADMX is the latest version. Be aware of the ADMX migrator. This was actually called out specifically. So if you haven't seen that, be aware of what it is. It's a free download GUI conversion, and you can also do a command line. There's some blog posts about it out there. Be familiar with maybe 5-10 minutes on that. And then property filters, I'm not going to cover this. Not very important, just knowing that you can filter some of the settings so you don't look at 500 or 1,000 settings. All right, so manage GPOs. Know about backing up, copy, import, all that kind of stuff. Know the PowerShell method. So backup-GPO, all those kind of things are going to come into play. And then know about the sample scripts. So you can run like the reports, the unlinked GPOs, the backup all GPOs, all those sample scripts that are in there, they may be called out as an answer choice. And then the migration table. So the migration table is when you're moving like a GPO from one domain to another. And it comes up and, you know, you have a UNC path or a domain or anything that's hard-coded in the original GPO that's not going to make sense in the new location. That's where your migration table comes in. Know about what it is when you use it. Probably don't need to know too much more than that. Reset default GPOs. You get a new job, default domain policy, default domain controller policy is used for everything. It's a mess. You want to start over. That's what you do right here. DC GPO fix, you can do target the domain, which is the domain policy, or DC, domain controller policy, or both. So that's important. And then delegate the group policy management. This is for your help desk, stuff like that. Know that you can actually delegate this stuff. The group policy creator owners group, know about that. It's going to be minimize administrative permissions. Do you use administrators group policy? You know, can they still do this? Know about what they get from it and know about how to minimize those. Okay, group policy preferences. I touched on this just a little bit earlier. The bold part of this slide is the actual call out of the OD. But beware of the tattooing scenarios. Remove this item when it no longer applies. Apply once and do not reapply, meaning that you know you may not have consistent settings out there when you do that. Item level targeting. Use a single GPO, but actually apply different settings to different computers or users. That's what item level targeting is. You may even get a scenario where the answer is item level targeting. You may not need to know exactly deeper than that, but you need to know what it is, when you might use it, when it might be a better choice than having two GPOs. And I kind of call out the target, specific CPU, battery presence. The reason I call these out is because we're thinking laptops. You want a single computer policy across your whole domain, but you want laptops to have a certain power policy. It might be effective. Brings us to our next example question. You work at Woodgrove Bank. GPO 1 is linked to the OU named Corp. You need to link GPO named GPO 2 to the Corp OU, and you want GPO 2 to take precedence. So we talked earlier about enforce. That overrides pretty much everything. That's the way to do it. All right, so we've got about 3.5 minutes left. I'm going to talk a little bit, you know, maybe a minute or two. I'll take a few questions if you want. Related content, some breakout sessions, hands-on labs. Those are called out in the 410 as well. The related exams. I'm going to be at the info desk and at the study hall Tuesday, Thursday, Wednesday. I'll be working all week in the mornings for the most part. If you have a question, want to come up and chat for a few minutes after. Otherwise, I'm going to do the 412, another half an hour or whatever. So feel free to stick around for that if you're going to bang those out this week. I'll be here to help you. And then finally, the resources. These are the same resources you've seen from some of your other sessions. And finally, complete an evaluation on ComNet. And maybe you win an Xbox, but not the Xbox One. Thanks, guys.